Well, it's Bathrop Spears Broadsides time again. This time we are at April 6, 2025. Not much is going to be brought to you today regarding the current scene. Perhaps a few articles, perhaps a few follow-ups from earlier shows. But there is going to be two flashbacks. Primarily, that's what you're going to have an option to hear, both from 2004. January 18th segments of that particular netcast. I'm still trying to recover older parts of these archives, which seem to be, well, they've gone astray. And then there's a complete January 22nd, 2004. Why'd go back 21 years? Well, it was an interesting period. It was a period when there was continued pressure, potentially with a broader coalition. There was a group called the One Dance Summit that got set up on the Hill. It had to do with bringing in certain left-wing notables who then sort of staged a brief protest at City Hall around supporting ending the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance, which was done under the mayorship. That is to say, the protest took place under the mayorship of Scott Kennedy, who helped co-found the Resource Center for Nonviolence, but apparently didn't really believe in nonviolence toward homeless folks, at least not in Santa Cruz, when he got into power. It wasn't that he beat them up or sent out the police to beat them up, but the whole system of force used to enforce thou shalt not sleep, thou shalt not be able to survive at night without harassment, is a form of violence and brutality all its own, and quite frequent in different communities. And as I've said many times, we still have a sleeping ban, even though it's not using the word sleep anymore. They finally picked up that was not a very politic thing to do, and it also violated federal court rulings until that federal court Martin versus Boise decision was recently overruled by Johnson versus Grants Pass, which was hoisted up to the Supreme Court by bigoted cities and conservative think tanks. A sad day. But the same human rights are at stake. The same violations and abuses are happening. And they were even happening while Martin versus Boise was in flower, so to speak. But there were at least, they had to be more genteel about it. They had to make that is to say, city authorities had to pretend they were engaging in options to provide shelter, but they weren't in any meaningful sense in Santa Cruz offering shelter to people. They were destroying shelters in order to destroy encampments. The shelters they were offering were partial shelters under the rubric of the so-called pathway to housing, which didn't provide a pathway to housing for most people. And so it was a fraud which was designed to cover up essentially police activity, in my view. Although it, if you ask people who work for Funding Matters, which calls itself Housing Matters, the biggest shelter provider in town, they would tell you that you know, they would have many favorable things to say about it. But I don't, and I hope you take a clear-eyed view of it as well. Anyway, let's jump into the theme of where we're at and see where we're going.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's begin with a story from the Good Times, which I guess won't see print probably until next week, but it's online. Hundreds join Santa Cruz hands-off protest. That's hands-off protest of Trump policies. Over 1,000 gathered to demand an end to Trump policies. And that's by John Koenig. And here's the story. A sea of protesters gathered at the Santa Cruz County Courthouse on Saturday in solidarity with nationwide hands-off demonstrations, voicing their opposition to recent actions by the Trump administration. Size of the gathering easily surpassed that of a similar protest in February, estimated at 1,000. Demonstrators lined the sidewalk from Ocean Street to the San Lorenzo River Bridge and filled the parking lot in front of the east entrance where speakers addressed the crowd. Other protest rallies took place in cities across the United States and Europe, organized in response to the government cuts and threats to social programs and numerous violations of the Constitution and rights guaranteed by law. Unlike most recent demonstrations that have focused on single issues, hands-off agenda is a response to the threats to the Constitution, free speech, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the rights of women, immigrants, and all minorities, science research, veterans, schools and libraries, national parks, the environment, and NATO alliances. I'm going to interrupt the story to notice that's why this protest, which I think may be the one organized by Indivisible, though the word is not mentioned here yet in this story, has to do with fundamentally Democratic Party organizing, which is what my old colleague Keith McHenry thinks. I don't know. I wasn't at the protest. I did show up at a protest yesterday on campus supporting the rights of people in Gaza, those who remain, and it hasn't yet been blasted away by U.S. bombs dropped by Israeli guns and tanks and planes and drones. Notice that there's nothing about anti-war here. There's about let's keep the NATO alliance, which has nothing to do with anti-war. That has to do with prep for war and essentially establishing a power in Eastern Europe that is supposedly designed to keep back the Russian menace, which I've spoken about before. I think that there is a better understanding of that, realizes that there's provoking Russia by maintaining and surrounding her with bases and potentially hostile countries is no way to keep the peace, particularly with nuclear powers. And I've had that perspective for some time, and I've talked about it here as well. I recommend a book, Provoked, by Scott Horton. Libertarian perspective, but he and Dave DeCamp do a good job every morning on the antiwar.org website. I recommend people look at it there. And of course, Democrats have been all gung-ho, and so have the Republicans. Trump's talk about peace in the Ukraine and deals with Russia is, I think, showing itself to be talk, because the wars are continuing, and the funding of arming the Ukraine and arming Israel continues. Anyway, this article, which talks about protest, but not anti-war protest, goes on, and I certainly support hands off to the Constitution, free speech. It would have been nice if that had happened during the Biden regime, which is where the crackdown on the universities began, or became more intense. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the rights of women, immigrants, all these are nice talking points for the Democrats, but they don't do anything to really restore and advance them in meaningful ways when they're in power in any kind of basic way. And so it's as inequality of wealth gets more and more profound, which is okay with the Democrats who get, like the Republicans, bought into power, people turn to whoever somewhat desperately, will give them some kind of different perspective. And that, of course, is a con man like Trump. Or, I don't know. I don't want to call it, calling an incompetent zealot like Biden. Well, it's not that I want to cast stones or throw names. What I want to accurately characterize what's going on, and that's what we need to do. Anyway, here's more of the story about the protest, which is what I began and hopefully will continue with. Similar events were held in other cities. The Good Times story continues around the world, highlighting the widespread discontent with the Trump administration. Organizers and participants expressed their hope that these rallies would inspire further action and bring about positive change. Elon Musk drew as much ire as the president, I would call him the Führer, with several signs depicting his now-notorious stiff-arm Sieg Heil salute. The Santa Cruz demonstration attracted an unusually diverse crowd of activists, from witches on the courthouse steps burning sage to banish negative influences to parents bringing their children to their first protest. The negative influences like being kicked out of schools and, if you're trans, being denied medical assistance and care, which is, you know, the one issue that the Democrats did seize on after some pressure by activists. While many signs name specific issues like hands-off Medicare and hands-off free speech, one of the youngest in attendance, a boy of 6, held a sign that named his greatest concern, "My Future." Another protest organized by Indivisible, there it is, in Santa Cruz, Democratic Party organizing tool, is planned for May 1st. So we're going to have these protests, but of course my fear is that as when the Iraqi war was on the verge of beginning, the second one, in 2003, as they were about to begin bombing and occupying Iraq under the Republicans, there was the biggest demonstration Santa Cruz had ever seen. I think it's bigger than this one, significantly bigger. But then, after they invaded within the next month, nobody came out anymore. It was a virtue-signaling protest, a Democratic Party organizing. I don't know if it was Democratic Party organizing at that point, but I suspect it probably was. I was there protesting, and if I had more energy, I probably would have been out at this protest too, just to get some audio for you folks who are listening to this show to hear. But yeah, you got to keep coming back, and that's the issue. And it, I mean, we'll see, and maybe we'll do, depending on those of us who do keep coming back. I think around the deeper issues that both the Republicans and the Democrats have failed in, we need to somehow stand up to that. And, well, we do. It's really in all our hands. Anyway, that's the story. Briefly, hundreds joined Santa Cruz hands-off protest of Trump policies. Over 1,000 gathered to demand an end to Trump policies. That's not as many as gathered when Bernie Sanders came to town in 2016. But, of course, the problem with Bernie was he was the Judas goat that got everybody all excited and then led people to into the Hillary Clinton camp or, you know, into the Democratic Party innards. Which, you know, people aren't going to continue buying the same line after a certain point. At least, that's both hopeful, but it also leaves the road open to other bad things. Fascism is no longer considered such an excessive word these days. Anyway, there's another article in the local establishment alternative press Lookout, which shows a picture of from the air of they call it thousands of people at the rally in front of the county building and the courthouse, and it's by Wallace Bain, a former Sent Anal reporter. That's the Sentinel. And Tanya Ortiz, I don't know much about her, So many issues, so little cardboard, thousands turn out waving flags and signs for hands-off rallies in Santa Cruz and Watsonville. And here's the quick take. A gathering at the county courthouse drew an estimated 4,000 people in Santa Cruz, while another 300 converged on Watsonville's downtown plaza to protest the actions of Fuhrer Donald Trump's second administration. They call him president. I don't like to think of him as president. I don't like to think about these presidents at all. Thousands converged in Santa Cruz and in Watsonville on Saturday afternoon to participate in the National Hands-Off political rally against Trump administration. The Trump administration. Or the regime, as some may call it. The successor to the Biden regime. Volunteers at Indivisible Santa Cruz, one of the primary organizers of the local rally, said that more than 1,300 people had registered for the event in advance. The number actually attended in front of Santa Cruz County Courthouse on Ocean Street was probably two or three times that. It's really touching, said Indivisible Santa Cruz organizer Amanda Harris Altus, as the rally was dispersing about 2 hours after it began. See, they aren't setting up an encampment or staying to demand, which the brave students did at the university last May, because they realize they're going to be swept away. It's an opportunity to make a show without a substantial presence that might actually mean something. That's generally my reaction when people don't stay. But I understand people have jobs, they have things to do. But if you're really serious about this and you want to see a change, then it becomes a priority for you and you have to do something like that. This shows we can put out the call and people will answer that call. For 2 hours, and then goodbye. But let's see what happens next. The two local rallies were among the 1,000 similar gatherings Saturday across the United States in protest to the actions of Fuhrer Don's second administration. Organizers said the coordinated effort was meant to communicate the wide range of interests and issues, but not anti-war issues, that are under attack by Trump and the Elon Musk-led Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. Santa Cruz rally featured more than a dozen speakers before a large upside-down American flag, a symbol of distress. The program was hosted by local activist Ayo Banjo, never heard of this person. Among the speakers were District 3 County Supervisor Justin Cummings, that's the former city council member who sold out the homeless big time, and not to mention he also sold out rent control and also sold out the right to encamp, which we so desperately needed, and was about to be passed by a council majority in 2019 before he turned tail and ran. And Assembly Member Gail Pellerin. Speakers led the crowd in hands-off chants, and local NAACP President Elaine Johnson read verbatim from Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1967 Revolution of Values speech. But has the NAACP ever done anything regarding police abuse against African Americans in Santa Cruz, or demanded policy changes that were laid out by Black Lives Matter over the years? Not that I've heard of. The rally was given a festive, only in Santa Cruz vibe when local icon Crazy George Henderson led the crowd in performing The Wave over on Water Street, whatever The Wave is. On Water Street, another instantly recognizable Santa Cruz figure, Curtis Relaford, danced and played music from his famously star-spangled trailer truck. Santa Cruz is the model for the whole United States, he said. There's nothing but love in Santa Cruz. Unless you're homeless, of course, or poor. In which case, good luck finding a place to be. In the crowd, creative signs, costumes, and graphic t-shirts, very graphic in some cases, were everywhere. Mary Geyser of Santa Cruz showed up with an elaborately knitted creation of the American flag, dramatically unraveling, her symbol for a constitutional democracy coming apart at the seams. I had a lot of frustration and energy, she said, and I like to make things. A group of local women, all dressed as witches, were on the courthouse steps on the Water Street side, staging a public Max Hess... mass hexing of President Donald Trump and Elon Musk, casting a spell before the crowd every 15 minutes. Another woman wore the red shawl and white cap featured in Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. Yet another was dressed as Wonder Woman. "Compassion is my superpower," she said. As with any protest, the stars of the moment are the handmade signs, and the Santa Cruz rally featured hundreds, many on the hands-off theme of the moment. There were signs that were relatively pious and sober-minded, from "Jesus walks with us" to one quoting Thomas Jefferson, but there were many others that were much more crude, humorous, and referential, including "Orange Lives Matter," "Make Idiocracy Fiction Again," "Feminist Trump Fascists," and "I Will Not Obey the Red Hats." One woman had a sign that was simply 9 capitalized letters fashioned in a square, OMG, WTF, GOP. Oh my God, what the fuck, GOP, the Republicans. On the divider between the lanes on Water Street, Audra from Bonnie Doon held a sign with a quote from Senator Cory Booker from his record-setting speech from the floor of the U.S. Senate earlier this week, "If America hasn't broken your heart, you don't love her enough." And interesting that they actually took to the divider, because that was made illegal by the progressive city council. I know there was Martine Watkins or Justin Cummings or anybody else, but it became illegal to hold up a sign on the median, because of course homeless people tend to do that, seeking survival funds. "It just really struck me," she said, adding that on that evening Booker broke the record, she went to bed listening to his speech on headphones. Another sign expressing the staggering number of issues that spawned the protest, "So many issues, so little cardboard." The crowd demonstrated the wide diversity of the Democratic Liberal Left Coalition, from people proudly waving American flags to those protesting on behalf of Gaza. Aha! An actual mention of Gaza. Many, however, were mainstream people not used to attending such rallies. "I don't know what else to do," said Moose Mitchell, observing the crowd and waving his own sign. "I hate just standing around waiting for someone else to do something." The nationwide rallies are largely a response of liberal outrage at a number of Trump administration actions and initiatives, but in recent weeks, rank-and-file progressives have directed their wrath to leaders in the Democratic Party they say are not doing enough to confront Trump. State Senator John Laird was also on hand, though did not speak, when asked what he thought of the anger aimed at the Democratic Party by many in the general public in the weeks and days leading up to Saturday's rally. Laird likened the moment to the fight against AIDS in the 1980s, in which activists were all divided into various groups and factions. "We were all angry at each other then, too," he said. In Watsonville, around 300 community members filled the city's downtown plaza, carrying signs that read, "DEI makes America great." That's a diversity, inclusiveness. Something like that. And protect democracy. Olivia Millard, a number of Indivisible South County, said she'd never seen a rally this big in Watsonville in a long time. "I'm overwhelmed by the show of solidarity of people from across southern Santa Cruz County who are disgusted with what this administration is doing and are absolutely wanting to make their views known," Millard said. Protesters stood alongside the side of Main Street chanting, "Si se puede," and "This is what democracy looks like," as cars driving past honked their horns as a way to show their support. Millard said people showing up to Watsonville City Plaza on Saturday is an indication of how important the immigrant community is to the city. "Hopefully it helps send the message to our immigrant community. We love them, we value them, we know what they bring, and we're here for them," she said. "It's thrilling to see that people are ready to take to the streets," said organizer Nancy Falstich. "They're ready to unite across every kind of difference and say, we demand a government that's been a democracy for the people." I'm not quite sure what she means by that, but there's the word democracy in there somewhere. Of course, we don't have a democracy. We have oligarchy at the moment, and that isn't just because of Trump. Saturday's protests are not going to be the last time a protest like this happens in Watsonville, she said, adding that it's important for people protesting to realize they are not alone in what they're feeling and worried about. Having multiple events around the country or the county is great because it brings more awareness to what's happening, Falstich said. We do have the power that enough people uniting can stop the terrible things that are happening. They do not really have power over us. We may feel helpless in the face of this, but we really are not helpless. Unless you keep getting out there, you are. Watsonville protest speakers, including County Superintendent of Schools Ferris Saba and Blanca Balthazar Saba, Vice President of Student Services at Cabrillo College, spoke about advocating for the country's most vulnerable populations, including immigrants and the LGBTQ plus community. Immigrants don't come here looking for handouts. They come here with hope, strength, and dreams, said Balthazar Saba. Immigrants come to the United States to work and to raise their families, she said, but are often met with discrimination and injustice. We have a government that not only has renounced the responsibility to help those most in need, Sabah said. We now have a government that actively and deliberately targets the people. Sabah pointed to the efforts by the Trump regime to demand that schools and community organizations fill out loyalty pledges or risk losing funding. They are destroying our institutions, but they cannot destroy our resolve, he said. Sabah also encouraged the crowd to continue to take action and fight for justice. So let us raise our voices in rage and hope. Let them hear our cries from here to Washington, D.C., said Sabah. From coast to coast and around the world, Watsonville is here and ready for the fight. And again, that's a story by Wallace Bain, Tanya Ortiz, on the Lookout Santa Cruz website. And now it's time for some songs with social significance, and that's going to be the usual that you hear or have been hearing over the last month or so of these netcasts. David Rovics, his A History of the World According to David Rovics. We've reached the point where at his, if you're following it online, because that's where we're getting this stuff from, it's 2002 to 2004, and we're at, the U.S. invades Iraq again. It invaded once in, I guess it was, 2001, and then it invaded again in 1991, it started bombing, and in 2003, it renewed the invasion, and the song is called Operation Iraqi Liberation. Here it is.
The timing of the murder of Rachel Corrie guaranteed it would not become a major headline, since it coincided with the March 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. The rationale for invading and taking over Afghanistan in the wake of 9/11 had been that Al-Qaeda was based there, and even though the Taliban had not been involved, and even though they were offering to hand bin Laden over to Turkey, the U.S. had to teach those Taliban a lesson and lay waste to Afghanistan once again. If that rationale was weak, the rationale for invading Iraq was far weaker. Saddam Hussein was widely known as an opponent of groups like Al-Qaeda. Until not long before, he had been in a long war with the Islamic Republic of Iran. But now, somehow related to 9/11, Iraq had to be invaded again, and this time taken over and run by the U.S. until it was effectively de-bathified. In a telling slip, TV channels were reporting the name of the invasion as Operation Iraqi Liberation before they realized that the acronym spelled OIL.
We've got a situation and it calls for a solution that upholds our domination of the planet. We're gonna make our case and we're gonna make it well, and if you don't... Let me try that again. I've been driving, like, for 16 hours a day for the past 3 days, so I'm going to really... I'm not sure how well I'll do here, but I'll probably remember most of the songs. We've got a situation, and it calls for a solution that upholds our domination of the planet. We're going to make... take our case and we're gonna make it valid. If you don't like our logic, you can can it. We'll use impeccable intelligence from any country in the world, as long as we all see eye to eye. And if we don't find quite what we need, we know what to do. Just look into the camera and lie. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. You got it. We'll lie about the missiles and the nuclear research. We'll lie about uranium. We'll build military bases and smile for reporters as we give away bubble gum. We'll lie about Bin Laden, his connections with the Saudis. We'll lie about 9-1-1. We'll lie about the Baathists, their connections to Al-Qaeda, because we know there's none. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. We'll lie about the North Koreans and we'll lie about Iran. And don't mention Israel. Keep those nuclear weapons out of this song. And we'll all get together swell. And we'll liberate these people. We'll liberate their money. We'll liberate their soil. Their airports, will liberate their harbors, and we'll liberate their oil. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation.
Now we have a story from the San Francisco Chronicle of March 31st. Parole granted to officer convicted in 2018 shooting by Anna Bauman. A former Danville police officer was released on parole from San Quentin State Prison on Friday after serving less than 3 years for the 218 shooting death of a 33-year-old Bay Area man. The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation confirmed that Andrew Hall, 35, was released on parole Friday, quote, after serving his full sentence as required by law. In 2021, a Contra Costa County jury found Hall guilty of assault with a firearm, a felony charge that stemmed from a November 2018 on-duty encounter in which Hall shot Latimer Arboleda 9 times, killing him. Arboleda, whose family said he suffered from mental health issues, was unarmed and trying to flee from a police in a vehicle when Hall shot him. Hall was sentenced to 6 years in prison and entered state custody on April 22, 2022, according to the California Corrections Department. The agency said Hall received 2 days of pre-sentence credit and was eligible for credit-earning opportunities while incarcerated, allowing him to shave time from his sentence. The former officer's unexpected release from San Quentin on Friday prompted concern among advocates and family members impacted by police violence. Some activists gathered Friday afternoon to protest outside the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Office, according to local media reports. He's been given a get-out-of-jail-free pass by the system, said Adante Pointer, a civil rights attorney who represented the Arboleda family in a lawsuit against Contra Costa County. This is the type of behavior that undermines the credibility of the legitimacy of the system. And what legitimacy would that be? And its willingness to hold killer cops accountable. The civil rights lawsuit concluded in 2021 when Contra Costa County reached a $4.9 million settlement with the Arboleda family. Danville contracts with the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Office for police services. Michael Raines, an attorney representing Hall, said his firm played no role in securing Hall's release from prison. Rain said he does not believe that Hall received any favorable treatment. Contra Costa Sheriff David Livingston said in a statement released Friday that he welcomed Hall's release because he should never have been in prison in the first place. He made a split-second decision to protect his life and the lives of others around him when he was required to use deadly force on Arboleda, Livingston said. It's time we stop feeling sympathy for dangerous criminals and start supporting law-abiding Contra Costa residents and the warriors that defend them. Livingston cleared Hall of wrongdoing following a departmental review of the Arboleda shooting, but terminated him after the conviction. Less than 3 years after shooting Arboleda, Hall was involved in another fatal shooting in Danville. He responded to a call about a man throwing rocks from a highway overpass on March 11, 2021, where he found 33-year-old Tyrell Wilson with a knife. After Wilson refused to drop the knife and said, "Kill me," Hall shot him once in the head, according to county investigators. Wilson died in the hospital 2 days later. The Contra Costa County District Attorney's Office declined to file criminal charges against Hall in connection with the case. Hall is banned from returning to work in law enforcement under California law, which prevents anyone with a felony conviction from working as a peace officer in the state. And that's Anna Bauman's article in the March 31st, 2025 San Francisco Chronicle, parole granted to officer convicted in 2018 shooting. Latimer Arboleda, say his name. Tyrell Wilson, say his name. And in the same paper on the same day, although this one on page two, there's a small story by Jordan Parker. Driver dies trying to evade deputy. A driver who was fleeing from police was killed Friday morning after crashing into a tree and being ejected from the car, the Marin County Sheriff's Office said. At about 2:57 a.m., a Marin County Sheriff's deputy tried to stop a motorist who was driving recklessly in the area of Anderson Drive and Bellum Boulevard in San Rafael, officials said. The motorist did not yield to the deputy's sirens and emergency lights, instead fleeing at a high rate of speed and prompting a pursuit, the sheriff's office said. The car crashed into a tree about 2 minutes later, according to the sheriff's office. The driver was ejected from the car and declared dead at the scene around 3:12 a.m., the sheriff's office said. The identity of the driver is not being released until the family has been notified, the sheriff's office said. In response to the crash, the sheriff's office said it invoked its critical incident protocol and requested that the California Highway Patrol conduct a independent investigation, officials said. The Sonoma County Sheriff's Office Coroner Division is handling an investigation into the death, authorities said. And that's, again, driver dies trying to evade deputy, Jordan Parker. And I'd say the guy's name who got killed in the car crash, but they haven't released his name as of yet. And here's what initially appears to be a sympathetic story to folks outside. In the March 31st San Jose Mercury News, the headline and above the fold is, "They took all my stuff and threw it away. Homeless site property loss." There's a picture of a, looks like a crushing machine or a mini bulldozer. And underneath it, it says, "City officials and employees worked to clear and close down a homeless encampment along 42nd Street between Telegraph Avenue and Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Oakland. Homeless residents say their belongings are being tossed." It looks like they're being crushed to me, but I don't see any tossing going on. Cities such as Oakland and San Jose are supposed to store medication, tools, and more when tearing down camps, but residents and records dispute it's happening. By Grant Stringer and Ethan Varian. "When cities sweep homeless camps, the personal belongings of displaced, unhoused people, Bibles and medications, tools and tax forms, are supposed to go into storage. But as Oakland and San Jose crack down on encampments, following a consequential U.S. Supreme Court decision last summer, Johnson versus Grants Pass, cities are storing few items, according to records obtained by the Bay Area News Group. Unhoused residents say city workers are ignoring the law and callously tossing their possessions into garbage trucks during sweeps. Sounds like the standard process that they use in Santa Cruz. They took all my stuff and threw it away, said a homeless man living in an RV in East Oakland who would identify himself only as Sir Frederick. The 49-year-old city native who has been homeless about 6 years said he has repeatedly lost belongings during encampment sweeps, including his birth certificate, food stamps, card, and laptop, and has watched city workers throw people's things into dump trucks that should have been stored under the city's protocols. Officials in both cities insist they are following requirements for storing and returning belongings. Employees keep low inventory, they said, because residents are given advance notice of camp closures. Now, some of you more attentive listeners may remember when I and various HUF members went to try to reclaim property that we had specifically, or I should say some other HUF members, I didn't do it myself, had specifically marked to with the name HUF or the name of the person whose property it was or gave a description of the property, and we could get no satisfaction or find the property at all in going to the back of the police station where they are supposedly storing the property. So this is this was actually, what, 9 months ago nearly, when they were clearing out the Poganips, or doing one of their activities of clearing out the Poganips. It's a repetitive form of low-intensity warfare against the homeless that continues on and on and on. It was designed to make it less attractive for folks to be here. Regardless of what the constitutional rights are, human rights are, basic human decency is, it's supposed to be kind of established as the new normal, you see. Anyway, continuing with this story, across the country, courts have ruled that cities violated homeless people's constitutional rights when they seized and disposed of their belongings during sweeps. In Oakland, a 2022 court settlement with homeless locals required the city to store belongings confiscated during sweeps and made it possible for residents to retrieve them. In San Jose, an independent auditor warned officials a decade prior that the city was at risk of similar lawsuits if unhoused residents' personal effects weren't respected. Both cities since adopted protocols that items including stoves, medication, and IDs must be documented and stored for 90 days while allowing workers broad discretion not to store anything they consider soiled or hazardous for fear of contamination and bedbugs. City workers will collect clothes and tents in good condition, but not bedding. When workers store items, they record their owner's name, if they know it, or the location and date of the sweep. Homeless residents in both cities can call a phone number to retrieve their stored items, officials said. In San Jose, workers post the phone number on public notices at camps before sweeps, a spokesperson said. San Jose locals can also email the city, and workers will deliver possessions as unhoused people usually lack reliable transportation. In Oakland, homeless residents should call 311, a city spokesperson said. Officials maintain that city workers are following these protocols, but interviews with homeless residents and internal city logs obtained by Bay Area News Group, that's the group that San Jose Mercury News is a part of, paint a different picture. Detailed records of items city workers collected from camps, including tents and stoves, credit cards, medical devices, tools, one Bible and a drum, show relatively few belongings were stored last year. How puzzling. And even when officials did store items, homeless people rarely collected them, the records show. For instance, in San Jose, officials cleared about 500 camps last year and stored 35 bags of items from about 35 locations, according to the records, and also stored were several walkers and a ladder. Only in one instance were belongings retrieved, the remains of a camp swept in March 2024, including a tent, a phone, and medical items. City employees disposed of the rest after 90 days of storage, per city policy. Now here they claim that, that is to say the writer of this story claims it, but doesn't suggest that this is the what they're being told. They're sort of suggesting that they maybe saw that the items were kept for 90 days. There was documented proof of it. But no, see, in the and previously in this story, they've said they're quoting these officials' claims. But when they stop saying the city officials said this, they're giving more credibility, veracity, and substance to these claims than perhaps should be given unless they're claiming they actually have more evidence that these things happened and not simply that they were told that they happened. In Oakland, just two homeless residents retrieved their belongings last year. Oakland workers had collected roughly 175 individual items from about 40 sites but swept more than 200 camps in that time. As in San Jose, the rest was thrown out after 90 days had passed, according to the logs. San Jose resident David Torres, 56, who has lived outside off and on for about 15 years, at last they start talking to the people who suffered these thefts. There's a reason people don't claim their property. There's a reason that having to do with the fact that they, what are they going to get it together and they have, where they have no place to put it? There are no storage facilities for them. They are in a position of homelessness without access to housing or even shelter. And just to have to be ticketed again and driven away again, I'm afraid not. That's kind of crazy-making, I would say. Anyway, San Jose resident David Torres, 56, who has lived outside off and on for about 15 years, said city and water district employees tossed nearly all of his possessions during a January sweep of Penitentia Creek in San Jose, or Penitentia Creek, including new tools, food for his dogs, and a bicycle. On countless other occasions, he said, he's had to start over without clothes, generators, or critical paperwork like his birth certificate and his ID. We have all of that in our tents, he said, and all of that gets thrown away if we can't grab it. He said workers gave him advance notice of the sweep this winter, but he couldn't save his own belongings because he was helping move his neighbors. After every city-directed sweep he's endured, Torres said, he has called the city phone line to locate his missing belongings. He was told the city crews determined there was no personal property at the site. That's typical for other homeless residents in the area, he said. Everyone has called it, and they never have anything of anybody's, he said. A spokesperson for the city of Oakland did not respond to a request to visit the city's storage facility. San Jose officials denied a request. To protect people's belongings, we do not disclose the address publicly and do not allow members of the public access to the inside of the facility, City of Jose, San Jose spokesperson Amanda Rodriguez said in an email. And she instead sent Bay Area News Group a photo of a dozen or so bagged items on shelves. In an interview, San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan said we might call him Matt Mayhem, has robust protocols to give unhoused residents plenty of advance notice before a sweep. That's why the city collects relatively few belongings, he said. Most people choose to pack up their things and move to another location, Mayhem said. When employees do collect and store items, not many people take us up on that offer to have them delivered, the mayor added. Delivered? Advocates for unhoused people scoffed at that notion. People have lost a lot of stuff through cleanups and abatements, said Gail Osmer, an advocate in San Jose. She said that many homeless residents won't call the city phone line at all. They don't call because they know their stuff isn't there, she said. Under Oakland's official bag and tag policy, the city will store up to 1 cubic yard of materials for an unhoused person, a city spokesman said in an email. Luca Giles, who has witnessed about 75 sweeps in Oakland, as a member of a community network that helps unhoused people, said the city definitely does not follow policy once the eviction is finally started. I've very rarely seen them bag and tag, they said. Typically, city workers put everything in the dump truck. Frustrated, Giles personally stores items for unhoused people displaced from a camp, from suitcases to clothes and electronics, until they land at their next spot. A spokesperson for Oakland did not make a homelessness policy official available for an interview, but said in writing that Oakland follows the terms of its legal settlement with unhoused residents in 2022, including around the storage of personal belongings. Well, a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision in June granted local governments, Johnson versus Grants Pass, broad authority to clear homeless camps. Laura Riley, an attorney with UC Berkeley, said that doesn't mean cities now have the green light to throw out encampment residents' possessions. Homeless people are still protected from unreasonable seizures under the Fourth Amendment, and the recent High Court ruling Grants Pass versus Johnson doesn't have a direct impact on those protections, Riley said. Ray Bramson, a former homeless policy official for San Jose, who is now chief operating officer of the nonprofit Destination Home, said losing one's belongings exacerbates the suffering of being forced to relocate. But he said it's an impossible task for public workers to sort critical personal items in what can be vast encampments during sweeps. It's just such a difficult task when you're dealing with thousands of people outside, Bramson said. And that is a story in the Mercury News from March 31st. Homeless site property loss. They took all my stuff and threw it away. Story by Grant Stringer and Ethan Varian of the Bay Area News Group, which apparently went to some trouble to get more details than usual, and then posted some of their findings, mostly the apologia or the excuses of the city officials, on the front page. Let's take another musical break. So Rovix introduces this song, which is called Miami, with the phrase, "The global justice movement is drowned in tear gas in Miami, outside of the free trade area of the American talks, of the Americas." A free trade area of the Americas talks. So here's Miami.
Meanwhile, in the USA and many other countries, the global justice movement was still going, though in a diminished form in this newly remilitarized period. It had become common practice for cities that were going to be playing host to a big gathering like a summit of the representatives of the free trade area of the Americas. They might hire a police chief from some part of the country that is seen to have had a lot of practice dealing with these outside agitator types. Generally the type of guy who is prepared to crack some protester heads and maintain order. In Miami, police had been shown footage from the WTO protests in Seattle that gave them the impression that cops had been killed there, which certainly was not the case. It was the fall of 2003. The police violence meted out against protesters there for the FTAA meetings was so extreme that, as with other social movements in the past, it played a big role in curtailing further gatherings of that kind of scale.
Leaders of the world had gathered to make the planet freer for free trade, to create a better business climate for all the profits they had made. Surrounded by an army, there for their defense, armed with APCs and copters and lots of common sense. Behind a fence, behind a wall that shouts, "You shall not pass." Broken skulls, plastic bullets, and 1,000 gallons of tear gas. And the world leaders kept on talking behind the moat upon the hill. And they boasted of prosperity in their latest free trade bill. They thank God, they thank Boeing, they thank the World Bank. They thank the firepower of the M1 tank. They defended their positions and the glory of their class. with broken skulls, plastic bullets, and 1,000 gallons of tear gas. On the streets we chanted, we have no clubs or guns. We've just come to tell the people the evil ways this system runs. But the truth can set us free, the rulers all knew well. So they drowned the truth with copters and the ringing of the bell, with their tasers on our bodies and our faces in the grass. Broken skulls, plastic bullets, and 1,000 gallons of tear gas. Cameras hid behind the lines, 500,000 men in blue. When the rich men moved their lips, they recorded them on cue. The occupation of a city by an army of police wasn't worthy of a mention from the reporters of the peace. Neither were the wounded children or the boarded glass, or the broken skulls, plastic bullets, and 1,000 gallons of tear gas.
And every week there is a HUF meeting, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which on alternate weeks, it's sort of run by Athena, who has generously agreed to take this thing off my off my hands. Anyway, the stuff that goes on there can be of interest, I think, to hear how what people are really experiencing. We actually have real homeless people there, mostly a majority of people who are sheltered, or some of them housed. Shelters means they got placed in a temporary shelter. Housed means they got, you know, maybe they're actually renting, or in some cases they own their own house. It happens too. In any case, there's a dialogue that goes on as I struggle to make announcements, tell people about upcoming protests, encourage resolutions, and also try to have a semblance of a democratic process, which is to say a process by which people can learn from each other and then decide what they want to actually do and not just talk about. But that's in the future, I fear. I mean, I hear. I mean, I believe, unfortunately. It is the experience I find. So let's hear a little of this.
You can spend $10,000 on a Catholic outfit.
Absolutely. It is my goal not to do so.
Should I begin and interrupt Barbara Monica?
You can see the ads in Vanity.
Hello, we're listening to Robert.
Robert.
Believe it or not. All right, so here is your agenda. Everyone consult your agenda. Oh, yeah. Oh, you suggest. First of all, everything is being recorded, so you're on tape, so to speak. Or audio.
Is that for our protection or for
your... that's for your incarceration, actually.
Oh, yeah.
As you know, I'm a friend, always a friend to the homeless, except I don't seem to do anything except read agendas. But that's another story. All right. No handouts at the moment except the agenda. I talked to Manish, who is the fellow who gave us the project last time, but I think you were interested in a bit, Troy. You need some money to get it started. He wants to have it. He's been around a different place. Remember Manish, the guy at the end of the meeting? He had a long discussion.
He wants to do a film and a clothing creation.
A who?
He wants to do film, and he wanted to also do like job training and selling of clothing, right?
Something like that. Yeah, I mean, he said he sent, I think he sent you his proposal. He sent it to you, Venus. He sent it to Dora?
Walmart?
I don't know if he did.
Yeah, I don't know if he did either, but I know that he had a conversation with Dora afterwards. So
okay, I'll check
did.
It with Dora if he sent it to Dora.
So what I did was, he said, you know, when I talked to him today, because we spoke on the phone, he said, nobody responded to my project. And I said, instead of being mean and nasty and saying, nobody gives a shit, or nobody likes it, or everyone's too busy, or, you know, different times for different folks, perhaps. But I did say that you, I think, seemed to be interested, Troy.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if you were, but
I was.
That's what I remember.
Yeah, I said I would do it. I didn't know if you called me, though.
Yeah.
And so sometimes my phone has got power, sometimes it don't.
Well, I tried to call him, and I went to an answering machine that hadn't been set up, so I couldn't get through to him. So I texted him. I'm learning how to text.
Wow.
Pretty good. And he called me back, or I called him back, finally, and I told him he's welcome to come to the meetings. If anybody's interested in what he's proposing, it's best, I guess, to catch them on the edge of the meetings or in a very brief presentation about the latest on his project. Also, how he's being treated by other people. I want to know if the Homeless Garden Project is, you know, shall we say, putting him out to rest, or, you know, he was fired from Homeless Garden Project, is what he said.
Oh, no.
And, I mean, that was the first thing he said at the meeting, one of the things I noted that it happened to him. Anyway, so I put him on the agenda just in case he shows he wants to make a 2 or 3 minute presentation.
Not really interested.
But that would be up to
what he wants to start, his foundation or the thing that he wants to do.
Yeah.
That's his cake. I got my own.
I understand. I think most of us have something similar. Follow-up on Justin and Athena, TRO trauma suggestion. This was an interesting thing that came up, you may remember.
Yes.
Last meeting, where he says he got a TRO against the police department. I would like to get that verified, not because I think he's a lying scumbag, but rather because I want to see if it's still operative. And get some evidence of it. You may remember we all trucked off to Watsonville in the Troy matter when we should have looked first to see if, you know, we're going to get anywhere. Although maybe you've been good to go anyway. I mean, that's possible. So
we learned the lesson. We just learned it in a more difficult way than maybe had to learn that lesson. Yeah.
I'm wondering if the statute of limitations should apply to someone that has suffered harm and loss.
It probably does.
It does.
Yeah.
Sadly, that's one of those rules that's pretty hard.
Unless
is the statute,
you know,
of limitations.
President Trump. Now, maybe if you get some kind of action going there.
I would like to have an executive order on a couple things.
Yeah,
I bet you would.
Coral sent a thing to be announced.
Coral.
But it's for today.
What's Coral's announcement?
Is it that Coral got swept?
She says.
Coral first. Then you.
All right. There's a thing, Panetta at Coconut Grove today.
Oh, yeah.
The third is yesterday.
No, the third is today.
Right, you are. You're correct.
It's at 5 o'clock, Coconut Grove.
Is it open to the public? I guess it probably is. Cause
I swear that's a place at Mario. I don't know.
Support.
Speak to the hearts of members of our community who may not be aware of Panetta's tragic record of supporting Netanyahu.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Today at 5 at
Coconut Grove. If anybody can come, it looks like.
I heard he's winning an award, which is half the reason why there's going to be a protest outside.
Oh, I see. There's a protest outside, but an award inside.
That's I think.
And then there's going to be a singing vigil tomorrow.
Yay, I think that's so hilarious.
His office.
What time?
I can't believe you got a typo in here.
3 o'clock.
He's just a human.
No.
2 to 3 p.m. tomorrow on April
4th. Yeah, his office. Outside his office.
71 Ocean, third floor, I suspect.
Yep.
All right, well, so that's it.
So that's coming up today and tomorrow. So I don't know, I guess, is there any follow-up so far from Justin? I was going to try to call him. I completely spaced him out. He didn't call me.
Yeah.
You heard anything from him?
I haven't seen him.
Okay, so there's that. I'm laying down essentially as a series of things you can pick up on if you want, or the group can pick up on.
The group.
Legislative follow-up on AB 750. This is Laura Chatham's.
If she comes, we'll get announcements.
What's that?
If she comes, she'll give announcements.
She will, yes. It's good. That's shelter rules, which may not make a dime's worth of difference. Bob, you had your hand up. Sorry.
Can you smoke at the homeless shelter in a designated place?
Which one?
They do not have a designated place, is my understanding. And that is one of the top complaints.
They do.
Are you sure? Which shelter
not
are you talking
armory.
About? I was talking about the Armory. Are you talking about Housing Matters or the Armory?
Well, both, actually, be interesting. So, one, Housing Matters does have and you can smoke pot there, I'm sure.
No, outside. You cigarettes. If they catch you smoking pot, you'll be kicked out.
Are you serious?
That's the policy on paper.
They don't have I'm actually kind of shocked by that, because I read this story here, and assumed that she was trying to smoke pot indoors.
But what's the story?
That's not necessarily true.
What's the story?
It's about an Orange County homeless shelter person being bounced out because they were smoking pot.
They didn't say pot.
That really could be
on
outdoors.
The premises.
That really could be outdoors.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I'm kind of shocked.
No,
because,
that is,
you know,
that
we're ducking 2025.
The armory also doesn't have a smoking section. You're not
outside the gate, did you?
Outside.
Oh, you have to. Yeah.
Outside.
Outside.
Okay. Well, that's what I mean.
Had a charger in here. I can use.
You can, so you can outside. They have a designated spot outside.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
Isn't that? I mean, that's all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the homeless, the Housing Matters does as well, outside. Well, that's cool. But she's claiming. I think she was inside.
Okay.
The person in the story.
The construction, but when I was there, they had a gazebo in the back.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. You can't just blow that off, as it were.
So the next thing is the Evan Morrison meeting report. I have an audio of some of that meeting, if anybody wants to hear it. Athena, you've heard it, or maybe you haven't.
I can give you a report.
Yeah, you can give me a report because you've heard it or because you haven't. Which, this is
wait, what meeting?
The audio meeting that my...
Of their internal meeting?
No, no. The meeting that I had with Evan Morrison.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And we also had Alicia Poole, who's also there by phone.
I would love to hear that audio recording if you wanted to play it.
Okay, now remember, we could play it, but you have a copy of it.
I know I do, but I haven't listened to it on my own.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying you should necessarily. It was more of, I don't know, Gloria, you were there. Do you have any recollection of high points? I asked all the questions that I put in the thing that you saw at one of these past meetings, which is, you know, can you make the rules changes A, B, and C for visitors, for having access, having us setting up a table outside if we want to get...
I guess my question is, was he a smooth politician, or did he answer any of your questions?
I don't remember.
Or did he just dance?
I don't remember being impressed with anything he said.
Yeah.
I may be too harsh on him, as you know. We have, you know, I...
And you had Alicia call into the...
Alicia called in and talked about her experience with shelters. Alicia Cool.
Okay, yeah.
Homeless union person. Yes, Troy.
I have a very important update I wanted to get over. To download the debrief when you're finished.
Okay. And I'll be finished probably in about 5 minutes, but if you want to do it...
I forget everything by then.
Well, don't. Well, then... Well, no, I know how that is. I do the same thing.
This is Connor, right?
Huh?
This is Connor. He fell asleep under the levee last night across the trigger. He stole his backpack.
Who is this again?
He's they here, meeting city workers
here
or community?
He's for a job from Reading. He said he went through hell in Reading.
Oh.
So now he's here. He's had an interview. He didn't get the job with a construction company. I said, you should go apply at Corporation Santa Cruz. We could get him to be our undercover.
It's true.
I'm saying, this guy, look at that guy. He's GQ. He's perfect. We could get him in as a cop. We could get him in as a city worker. Anything. Look at him. He's right behind you.
Excellent.
These are my friends. I want to introduce you. So I already gave him the lowdown on this, you know.
Okay, well, that's good. Let's
but there's other things I have to talk about.
And I want
to
hear about that. And you're actually on the agenda. You know?
Okay.
I think. I put it on. It didn't disappear on me. So I can play you some of this audio with Morrison. It's probably more important to listen to you, Troy, than Evan Morrison. I was going to suggest as a response. I was going to initially suggest that we do some look at the stuff I suggested. Say what do we want, Evan, in terms of changes? And I realized there's no point in talking to Evan about the changes really, unless you have some power and some punch.
Yeah.
And so therefore, the idea is to get punch. How do you get punch?
And Evan Morrison, as regular listeners may know, is the head of People First, which is the group that runs the Armory Shelter, which is sort of the main low-barrier shelter. But it's still being done on this pretext of getting a pathway to housing. You can't walk up to it because you have to be driven up to it. They spend a lot of money on these transportation stuff. And you can't have visitors. At least not those who can walk in freely, as we were able to get with the 1220 River Street encampment that's now run by the city, though before it was run by, I guess it was the Salvation Army. I think that's right. In any case, Morrison came to several of our meetings. We actually played one entire conversation we had with him, and he mainly kept saying he didn't have the statistics. He sounded like he wanted to express what he knew of the situation. He urged that he would come back with statistics. We asked him to make those stats available before the next meeting. He called and said he needed to postpone the next meeting. We said, well, give us something at the meeting. He didn't respond, or he finally, I don't think he responded to that. Then later, he finally came to another meeting, but and we had a private meeting with him too. I should say a meeting outside the Huff normal meeting time, which is Thursday from 1:30 to 3:30 for all you aspiring would-be Huffsters if you want to come join us. But the real issue is, how are people being treated up there? And the complaints we were hearing about restrictions and unfair exclusions and so forth, which were admittedly from the people who bothered to come to the Huff meetings or who had talked to Huffsters about it. So we wanted, I thought the best thing would be to set up a table up there and invite people to come and talk about things positive and negative about the Armory shelter. And so far, that permission has not been granted. And I told Evan that we weren't going to ask for permission. We would simply show up and do what we needed to do, because we think people have a right to talk to folks, even if we're not given permission, you know, that sort of thing. Play a little bit more of this. Just giving you some idea of the kind of stuff we talk about, the kind of agenda that I try to run through every meeting, and how people react a little bit. Let's hear some more.
Well, first of all, I suggest we continue using the unused Google line, which I called up this morning. That's 218. It goes now directly to Gaia's phone.
Oh.
And she said it hasn't been used by anybody else. What I'm saying is, I don't expect that that's going to happen until people start really
advertising,
getting hassled, or there's more advertising or as an option. Although I don't know if she's up for keeping it. She may be losing her housing.
Yeah.
She's about to lose, the rent control is about to go, and she can't afford the rent. She has a mobile home, or it's not even mobile. It's just whatever they call those things that they put on concrete.
How many people are getting into this building already? She should go get on the list.
There's a coffee if you all want some.
Yay!
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Look back on the Saturday and Sunday's events that were happening last week. There was Evans. Let's all talk about trauma, homeless trauma.
Oh, sorry.
There she is. All right.
Very tired.
And the second one is Funding Matters and their event at the Hotel Paradox. Oh, what a paradox it is. So did anybody get to that, hear about it?
I went to both, and my reports on them are way less important than maybe anything else we could talk about. So I will do it very quickly.
Yes.
And again, Evan Morrison was not only the head of People First, he also wanted to organize this meeting with service providers, which Athena is about to talk about. That was a meeting that last Saturday, I should say Saturday before last. And then on Sunday, there was a meeting at the Hotel Paradox by the Speakers Bureau of the Housing Matters, or Funding Matters, as I call them, group, which I get it sported one homeless person or one person who's a frequent, visible around town as connected with homeless causes, Curtis Relaford. Otherwise, just a bunch of speakers about how nice it would be if we could all communicate better with each other and so forth. But of course, what about the actual procedures and policies and collusion with the police that really bothered us regarding Funding Matters, or Housing Matters, as they call themselves? Anyway, here's Athena talking about both these two meetings?
Lame. They were pretty lame. They were spectacles, and they were pretty lame spectacles. But for, like, if your question going into this was, what are we going to do immediately now to make things better? What are we going to, is this event going to magically now do something better? No, of course not. One of them, Evans, was an attempt to build across divides. And that's never going to happen in a single day. And I hope he continues to try, no matter how painfully awkward or silly or uncomfortable it might be. I believe in Evan's goal of his meetings, but the meeting itself ended up being just Huffsters and the chief of police, and it was fucking hilarious because it was just Huffsters and the chief of police. There was no service providers there. It was fucking hilarious. There was like 3 service providers, a good 8 Huffsters, and the chief of police.
You brought the Huffsters?
Yeah.
And did they commend the chief on his getting rid of, making it uncomfortable for the homeless?
The chief, who is more of a politician than a cop, but he's a magic mix between the two, did a very good job jumping around. He didn't talk about trauma almost at all. He didn't talk about his own trauma. He talked about how hard it is to be a cop generally. And it was awkward and stupid. However, I hope Evan keeps trying, because I think the idea will take a long time if it ever does work.
Which idea?
The idea that if you make activists, service providers, city workers, and homeless people get into the same room, break bread with each other, and really talk, and it's only people that show up that want to do that, which is unpleasant for most people, that it is useful. And as a singular event, it isn't useful, but as a process, I really do think it is useful, so I hope he keeps doing it, because with more time in advance, I can get more people there. And I think if it wasn't on a Saturday, he would have gotten some of his own workers there. But because it was a Saturday, it was just Huffsters, and it was kind of hilarious. And we did have good conversations and have fun.
Was there food?
There was food. And then the Sunday event, the Housing Matters event, was a series of speeches that were heartwarming and inspiring. And that's all that they set out to do, was to make an event where we talk about community and compassion, and it was inspiring, and that's all they set out to do, and they accomplished it, and the speakers got paid, and the speakers were mostly, if not entirely, locals that could really use a paid speech
audience?
Opportunity. Audience was mostly service providers, a few politicians, only a few though, and supposedly they handed out a lot more free tickets this time. I got that information from Andrea Feltz, who is the head of community education or something. Her
and what Athena's talking about is the Hotel Paradox meeting the day after the Evan Morrison meeting, which she had to pay $30 to get into.
And another girl. Both the women are like, they're working on building more events that are more approachable. They are working under some very unapproachable staff, but both of the younger women, Andrea and Marlena, do seem to earnestly want to create more approachable events, and I think they really did give out more free tickets than they have in the past.
Hey, Laura.
It's musical break time again. It's Spanish journalists go on strike. And that's the name of the song, Spanish Journalist Strike.
The invasion of Iraq in 2003 was illegal, according to the UN. But the US did have the participation of other countries, especially ones that had right-wing governments at the time, who thought highly of the Bush administration, Spain under Prime Minister Aznar among them. A year after the invasion of Iraq came the coordinated subway bombings in Madrid, March 11, 2004, which killed hundreds of commuters. As with the Twin Towers or any number of other attacks, the victims were civilians. This was not a military target. What seems to have been notably different between the two cases of New York and Madrid is how the political consequences played out. In Spain, at least, when the right-wing prime minister tried to blame Basque separatists for the bombings because he thought this might be more politically convenient for him if it were true, the response of the voters was to vote him out of office and Spanish participation in the occupation of Iraq at the same time. Part of the response to Prime Minister Aznar's propaganda efforts came from the journalists themselves.
The battle had been raging for how long it's hard to say. We were there to tell the story of the slaughter come what may. We didn't hide behind the lines, we reported on the crimes for BBC, Telemundo, and the Sunday Times. They said we were in danger, bearing witness to the war. A half dozen had just been killed in the days before. Then came the day they bombed Jazeera and Abu Dhabi TV as well. At the same time they took aim and shelled the Palestine Hotel. 4 journalists were murdered in a single day. And then our own Prime Minister, Aznar, was to say, there will be no investigation. Such a thing would not make sense. It was just a tragic accident. So at his next press conference, Aznar approached the podium to give a national address. Gathered all around him, the men and women of the press. He opened his mouth, we put our cameras on the floor, dropped our notebooks, turned our backs, and walked right out the door. We marched down the street and left our cameras where they lay. 'Cause all the news that's fit to mention is there is no news today. We were not embedded in your networked play-by-play. We were just reporters, reporting day by day. We were trying to do our jobs, bring the Baghdad street, whether it was victory, massacre, or defeat. And those 3 missiles told a story that's not hard to surmise. The army has decided what's good for the global public's eyes. These missiles weren't coincidence, of this there is no doubt. And on that April afternoon, asesinos, we did shout. We marched down the street, left our cameras where they lay. 'Cause all the news that's fit to mention is there is no news today. What happens to the message when the messenger is shelled? What happens to a nation that says it's just as well? What happens when the embeds are the last ones left alive? Is this your brave new world in which our liberty shall thrive? We marched down the street, left our cameras where they lay. 'Cause all the news that's fit to mention is there is no news today.
So here's an older story from the Mercury News, March 18th, 2025. San Jose controversy, county blasts homeless proposal. Leaders call the mayor's plan to arrest those who refuse shelter a distraction from the real problem, by Grace Hass. As San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan, who calls himself Matt Mahan, I think it is, looks to institute a new policy that would allow police to cite and arrest homeless people who repeatedly refuse shelter, Santa Clara County leaders are calling the proposal ineffective and a distraction at a time when 1,400 individuals are on the county's shelter waiting list. Mahan's responsibility to shelter proposal is part of San Jose's broader crackdown on homelessness in recent months, as the city has created tow-away zones for RVs and extended the hours when homeless residents are banned from sitting or lying on downtown sidewalks. Since the mayor assumed office in 2023, San Jose has shifted to utilizing more interim solutions in an effort to achieve functional zero, quote unquote, when the number of people exiting homelessness is more than those entering, instead of focusing on building permanent supportive housing. So, you know, if you arrest them, I guess they're no longer homeless. Or if you scare them away, they're no longer around to be counted as homeless. This is a brilliant plan. Let's see what else we got here. It's the story continues. His March, that's Mayhem's March budget message, would levy misdemeanor charges for trespassing on homeless individuals who refuse shelter or housing three times in an 18-month period. And since there's no shelter room and there's a long waiting list, I think what they really want is for police officers who are telling people to move be instantly obeyed, and that if they don't, that amounts to refusing shelter. That is what I'm afraid may be happening here, but I don't know. Now, the mayor says the city has done all it can and that Santa Clara County, the area's social service provider, needs to step in. San Jose is doubling our capacity of shelter units and increasing enforcement. We need Santa Clara County to do the same, Mahan said in a statement to Bay Area News Group. Now, usually in Santa Cruz, when people have been complaining about Santa Cruz's harsher laws, Santa Cruz and lack of shelter space, Santa Cruz says, oh, what about the county? It's their fault. They should be doing. So this is sort of a somewhat twisted kind of reflection of this old policy where you blame the county for not being harsher on these homeless people. We really tried to get rid of them, but you got to help us. You know, lend us some machine guns or something. Tear gas? I mean, I don't know, itching powder, loud electric lawnmowers, sprinklers to wake them up while they're trying to sleep on the grass. Or as Bernie Escalante was reportedly quoted as saying, how do we make life more uncomfortable for them? That's the Santa Cruz police chief. That can be an apocryphal story. And Bernie, get in touch with me if you claim that's not true. Santa Cruz is doubling our capacity of shelter units and increasing enforcement. We need Santa Clara County to do the same, Mayhem said in a statement to Bay Area News Group. Our county is the South Bay's provider of health and human services, and all you need to do is step outside to see the many homeless people who need their help. Throughout the mayor's 35-page budget message, he calls on the county and state to step up their efforts and appropriately share in the cost of supporting our most valuable residents. But County Executive James Williams told the Mercury News that the county has been doing much of that work and called the mayor's proposal to cite and arrest homeless individuals for refusing shelter ineffective and a distraction. I would invite the mayor to come sit down and understand just how extraordinarily greater the county's investments in these services are, Williams said. We would welcome the city coming to the table and bringing real resources. This is really critical right now because, unlike the city, the county is facing truly extraordinary federal impacts that could have crippling effects on these very populations that are dependent on these safety net social services, health care services like Medi-Cal and behavioral health services. Santa Clara County Supervisor Otto Lee, who serves as the board's president, echoed Williams' sentiments. In a statement, he said that it's inhumane to criminalize people for living outdoors. There is some serious misunderstanding of what rejecting housing means. Failure to return calls to housing service providers does not automatically mean the individuals reject housing. During the 2024-25 fiscal year, Santa Clara County invested $90 million in San Jose to tackle homelessness. Two-thirds of the county's funding for shelters serves San Jose. The county has also been working to expand areas or access to behavioral health treatment beds with the goal of adding 530 beds by 2030 and has applied for $114 million in Proposition 1 funding for mental health treatment facilities, two of which would be in San Jose. Proposition 1 is a 2024 state ballot measure approved by voters that aims to help local jurisdictions increase treatment beds and housing for homeless residents. It could be part of the Needles on Wheels program, which essentially allows much looser standards in incarcerating and forcibly drugging people. But you have to be able to provide them with housing at the same time, which has been the reason it hasn't really gotten too much traction since it was passed in, 25 years ago, there more or less. Santa Clara County Supervisor Susan Ellenberg said in an interview that she's proud of what the county is doing. "We are investing massively in homelessness prevention, in shelters as well as permanent housing, and mental health services and substance use disorder services," she said. "I think if you actually look at our data, you'd be pretty hard-pressed to be too deeply critical." Of course, though, she's not presenting the data. She's just making how wonderful we are claims. "Obviously, there is always space to do more, and we will continue to do more. But our investment is significant." Well, what are the number of homeless people, and how much money is going to homeless services, and what's been the impact on homelessness in the county? This does not appear in these articles, and on San Jose Mercury News, apparently, didn't ask these questions, or if it did, you don't know about it. The Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office, for its part, said they don't expect the proposed policy to have any impact on the jails. "We are not able to hold anyone in our facilities unless they've committed a serious criminal offense under the law," spokesperson Brooks Jarose said in an email. "Most likely, this would result in a citation and a release from custody." When asked whether Santa Clara County District Attorney Jeff Rosen would press charges against the individuals cited or arrested, spokesperson Sean Webby said they, quote, "look forward to hearing more specifics about the mayor's mayhem proposal, about the mayor's proposal, and whether it would involve a municipal code that city attorneys would prosecute or something else." Mayhem, told the Mercury News that Californians have demanded actions again and again through several recent state initiatives, including Proposition 1, Proposition 36, which could force repeat drug offenders into treatment, and CARE Court. The latter is a state-mandated mental health court that is currently being rolled out by counties with the goal of getting people with severe psychiatric disorders into treatment and housing. Or just the hell off our streets, if you want to look at the real bottom line. The state initiatives largely fall under the jurisdiction of the county. Williams said that while the county is committed to their effective implementation, it's important to actually understand what these things are and what they aren't. In the case of the CARE courts, Williams said, it's not some large vehicle or venue to sweep folks off the streets, certainly not. These are very targeted interventions. Mayhem's proposal to cite or arrest homeless residents mimics similar policies recently passed by other Bay Area jurisdictions. Last January, San Mateo County enacted a law that homeless residents camped in unincorporated areas of the county who refused shelter twice and have received two written warnings could face misdemeanor charges. County spokesperson Marshall Wilson said the county has not issued any citations under the law since it went into effect in early 2024. Jennifer Loving, the CEO of the nonprofit Destination Home, said that Mahan's proposal is a really good example of politics over policy. She believes it will only lead to more failure in the region's ability to address homelessness as the South Bay struggles to meet the need for both housing and services. In 2023, for every household that found housing, another 1.7 became homeless, according to Santa Clara County. "Our continuum of care has not had a problem filling units," Loving said. We have a problem with the lack of housing options for people. That's every day the number one, number two, number three, number four, number five biggest problem. And when we make it about other things, it's not going to solve the actual crisis. That's County Blast's homeless proposal. Leaders call the mayor's plan to arrest those who refuse shelter a distraction from the real problem in the March 18th Mercury News by Grace Haas. And now a bit of music, again, from David Rovics. This one is a song about a year after the U.S. invasion of Iraq when the insurgency against the occupation begins. That would be 2004, and the name of the song, Fallujah.
The U.S. occupation of Iraq had not been on for long before the resistance began. There were peaceful protests, protesters were massacred by U.S. troops, and armed resistance followed. All a very familiar pattern. In the course of the battles for the city of Fallujah, the first of which began on April 4, 2004, this city that had once been known as a city of mosques lay in ruins. 80% of the buildings in Fallujah had been destroyed in the course of the battle against the U.S. forces that ultimately claimed victory over the wasteland. One of many, many cases in the history of imperialism along the lines of, we had to destroy the city in order to save it.
Maybe you'll hear about me when you watch the evening news. So I write this letter for you, my friend, the truth then you may choose. I had a good time at Oxford, and the world I did roam. When my studies were finished, then I went back home. All I wanted were good things, land and liberty, and all the sorts of things we learned at the university. I'm not a fan of dictatorships, I'd rather say live and let live. But for those who threaten my family, there's nothing I won't give. I will fight for my country, I'll defend this land. I'll stare at the whites of your soldiers' eyes with this Kalashnikov in my hand. With this Kalashnikov in my hand. When you break down the doors of my neighbors, when you say that might makes right, when you say you're looking for terrorists in their bedrooms late at night, when you torture my brother at gunpoint, on his head a canvas sack, all I can say to you, soldier, is you'd best watch your back. I will fight for my country, I'll defend this land. I'll stare at the whites of your soldiers' eyes with this Kalashnikov in my hand. With this Kalashnikov in my hand.
Yeah. See, I'm gonna fight for my country, though I hate the war. But I deplore even more when they take me for. Think about where you live, how you typically be. When the bombs start falling in the middle of the street, it ain't difficult to see what side to choose. With all the lies they use, can't hide the truth. White lies from these white guys in the White House. Might as well wear white sheets while they wipe out. I mean, white out all opposition. And bomb call the people into submission. He's got a Bible, he's down with Jesus Christ. He likes blacks, just ask for the least of rights. It's all evil lies in a weak disguise. See the signs, read in between the lines. You wanna save America, I'll bring you support. Arrest the president and bring him to court. Charge him and his puppeteers of war crimes. And start paying reparations of all kinds. You think what I'm telling you to do is extreme, but if you live in Fallujah, it'd be a beautiful dream. So I hold my tears and my hopes and fears when you bomb our country and attack our town. Don't be surprised when the whole world cheers to see another Black Hawk down, motherfucker.
When you come with your tanks on our city streets, and you say these streets are yours, when you say you'll rebuild us with bombers and oil tankers on our shores, when you've gunned down my child in Fallujah, you needn't wonder why I look at you through the blades of your copter and say it's a good day to die. I will fight for my country, I'll defend this land. I'll stare at the whites of your soldiers' eyes with this Kalashnikov in my hand. With this Kalashnikov in my hand.
So last week I presented a portion of a conversation I had with sometime homeless activist, continuing homeless activist, Becky Johnson in Seaside down Monterey County, previously of Santa Cruz, conversation with her that got rather heated around the issue of differences around the Israeli occupation and genocide in Gaza, which of course she doesn't regard as a genocide. And I felt it instructive to, well, it can be infuriating, it can be perhaps educational to see how people of extremely different perspectives and yet who are still friends with each other can argue about an issue that is very current. There's, I think, going to be more of this than you can imagine, or there needs to be, maybe. Or maybe there needs to be a way of maintaining common ground on other issues that are even more important, that have to do with challenging existing authority, or bad authority, you might say. In any case, here's some more of that, and perhaps my occasional interruptions and thoughts.
So Mehdi Hasan is correct. Israel was controlling all those borders per the written agreement they already had with the Palestinians. Nothing illegal about it, and it didn't stop people from getting food or water or medicine, or they had a lot of restrictions because they were trying to keep them from building up a terror infrastructure. But that didn't work out very well, did it?
I would say that that's always been an excuse for repression in countless dictatorships throughout the world and countless ethnically cleansed states throughout the world. That has been an excuse.
We are ethnic cleansing.
Who
was ethnically cleansed?
Trump has declared that he wants to ethnically cleanse Gaza.
Yes, true. For the first time ever in the history of Gaza, somebody in power has said, maybe they should move somewhere else.
I don't think that's exactly how it was put. Human animals, I think, was what the people said at the beginning of the mass murder that began in October.
October 7th or shortly after.
He wasn't referring to the people.
He was in the war cabinet. One of his war ministers called Hamas human animals, not the Palestinians. He called Hamas human animals.
There is, if you look at the Israeli, you haven't concluded my sentence yet. You don't know what my source is.
All right.
My sentence was that the Israeli population, I'm not to hell with the government. This is the sad thing.
Well, this is Al Jazeera. That's your source, huh?
So
She's looking at my little lanyard around my neck, which encourages no taxpayer dollars for genocide in Gaza. And she claims that the photo here is of somebody that Hamas had nothing.
Your child's self-born.
Sorry, that the Israeli Defense Force had nothing to do with. That it has nothing to do with murder from the air and murder from siege and so forth. And the new murder that's now going on, even as we speak here at this, in my view. But what are we looking at? Are you looking at some photos?
Oh, I see it.
So anyway, getting back to the issue that we're talking about here. And what are we talking about? We're talking about we disagree on siege. There's some confusion, some difference of opinion, or I'm ignorant on this. I've got to review it to make sure that I have my facts straight around whether the Oslo Accord A is relevant to what we're talking about, and B, if it says what it says. My understanding is that there has been constant claims by the different forces that were claim to represent Palestinians, both peaceful, nonviolent, and violent resistance forces, which are, by the way, not terrorists when they're resisting an occupying force.
Okay, occupying
force. Means you can move your forces in, seize people without charges, jail them for years without charges,
but
and
Gaza
so forth.
Gaza has been sovereign since 2005. Israel.
In what way is it sovereign?
They signed the deed over to Gaza.
Hold it. I'm not talking about what's going on paper. I'm talking about the actual behavior of troops.
Exactly. You're talking about them controlling the borders, the sea, the air, and limiting what supplies can come in. You're calling that an occupation. That is false.
No, I'm calling
it. It's not an occupation.
We're calling
Gaza
it.
Gaza has not been occupied since 2005. Your side just gets it wrong all the time, and they cannot be educated on it.
No.
They can't.
I understand what you're saying. That prior to the latest murderous invasion and the numerous bombings,
the murderous bombings
throughout the years that have happened at various times, Operation what? Control Lead? I don't know what the hell it is. You know what the names of these operations are. Cast Lead was one of them.
2014.
Something like that. And there was a previous one in October in 2009 or perhaps 2007. I'm not sure. But in any case, there has been a matter of impunity where Israeli so-called defense forces have defended themselves by murdering Palestinians at a ratio of about 20 to 1, which they regarded as somehow having something to do with their defense. And now you see it, of course, happening in even greater terms. Huge numbers of people are dying. And, of course,
20 to 1. What's that?
The number of
20 is the number of Palestinians killed, and the 1 is what?
The number of IDF forces killed.
Okay.
Or even civilians killed in as a consequence of the.
Not what I've heard. I've heard that.
Okay, we have different sources. What are your sources here?
Well,
do you have any sources other than the Israeli government?
All right.
Forgive me.
Okay, I agree that the IDF are not getting killed at the same rate.
No. That's not adequate. I'm sorry. When it's 21, it's not at the same rate. It's a murderous overkill.
Okay.
That is.
You want to say, you know, like.
I would like you to be horrified by that.
Okay.
That's what I would like you to be.
More Germans died in World War II than
again
Americans,
when you
say that Germany was the victim because more Germans died.
That's the kind of false argument that you'll hear endlessly on Zionist broadcasts and Zionist supporters, of which I have always characterized you as one, Becky. But that's not logical. I don't know if that has much to do with the same. But it needs to be. Hey, you. Is this dog under orders from you, Becky?
Yes, I've.
Or is this the man who's involved? I can't tell for sure.
Sperm's angle. He's bothering me.
Oh my! See, this is a waste of good. Well, I won't get into the dog sperm elements of this whole.
Well, it is spring, and he's springing.
That's a good point. It is. It's March, so a brief introduction to explain what's happening. This. Becky's dog was this large, friendly, but should we say horny dog, was
attempting to hump various people, myself included, and also had some rather sharp claws in his affectionate attempt to jump up on you, which left wounds on me. But that's what's going on at the same time. There are other people in the room. Becky's son was William, eventually kind of enters the discussion. So did Huff activist Gloria. But we continue. To compare the total number of soldiers killed by Germany and America, they're all soldiers being killed. They're not civilians generally being killed. But the civilian, of course, then there are civilians on both sides being killed in the war. But I think it's a little different in the sense that I'm not aware that the Palestinians actually invaded with a military force recently or ever to take control.
Well, now, other than October 7th.
No, that depends on how you view it. You're about to say...
And then the IDF, apparently they were shooting their own, like they were shooting some of the...
No, that's all a mystery that this is a vicious Hamas slander that they would have do the what we call it, the Hannibal Directive, I think it's called, shoot your soldiers rather than let them be caught. That isn't really what the Israeli Defense Force does. Is that true, Becky?
I believe that there was some people were killed on October
6th. Here I was using a bit of sarcasm to see if how Becky responded to the claim that has, to me, been substantiated, but again, I don't have clear sources right now, that Israeli forces had been directed, they've at least acknowledged it, some officials have said this, Israeli officials, and Israeli military, that the they were directed to shoot to kill even hostages that were taken in order to stop them from being used for bargaining purposes.
7th with friendly fire.
Excuse me. Was there a Hannibal directive that was issued according to your best information from good Israeli sources?
I don't think so on October 7th.
Any time during this conflict in the last year and a half.
There, after Gilad Shalit had been kidnapped, and that really caused a lot of trouble, the military...
When was that?
Oh, 2005 or something, a long time ago. And he was held for a long time, too. And they ended up, like, releasing... 1,000 Palestinian prisoners to get him back or something like that.
You mean
that.
The Palestinians didn't bomb the hospital where he was being treated?
So when Gilad...
More sarcasm for me. It was probably an Israeli terrorist center, right?
How do you know that hospital wasn't bombed by an Islamic Jihad rocket that fell short? Or a Hamas rocket that fell short and hit it.
I was there personally. I observed every single moment. No, actually, I didn't.
And then the Ministry of Health runs out and says, oh, 500 people were killed by Israel. And then they say, oh, it was Islamic Jihad. I go, oh,
again, we going back to the Hannibal Directive, if you don't mind, Becky.
Your sources
back
suck.
back to the Hannibal Directive, Becky. You jump back to 2005. I asked you a simple question. Limit yourself in time and space to that if you can, and then you can elaborate the history.
Directive.
The Hannibal Directive between October 7th of 2023 and the current time. Is the Hannibal Directive, or has it been acknowledged it's operative in the war?
I don't think it's operative.
And you don't think it's operative?
I don't.
And your source for that is?
Well, my source is where the Hannibal
came from. It's not fair for me to ask you to prove a negative. So what I'm going to say instead...
I looked it up because I want, you know, people were saying that, and I wanted to know more about it. So I looked up the Hannibal Directive, is that what it's called? And... It came from the War Cabinet. I'm not sure whether it was Netanyahu or someone earlier, like Sharon or something. But they said that after Gilad Shalit was kidnapped, the cost was so high that perhaps in the future, if people see that the Hamas is dragging a soldier back to captivity, that they should fire on them to try to stop it from happening, even if they hit their own soldier.
So this is a sort of a hypothetical response to the requirement that the fear of the hostages being taken, and let's say
the cost being
to have to release many Palestinians who have been seized in the West Bank inappropriately, let's say, being held for long periods of time without charges and without trials, and therefore they want to keep them there as sort of bargaining chips for individuals that under unlikely circumstances, because it doesn't happen much as far as I know, government officials get taken. Like the man you mentioned, but again, you're not. So your source is, and I don't have my source about the Hannibal Directive except from my my supporter over here. This vicious. So what's
yeah,
your name again?
Shall
I call you Torpy for short, or Bill? Nobody ever called you Bill that I ever heard of.
You used to call him Willie, but then
I did. I called you Willie a many a time, as I remember.
Yeah, but I was still a child.
And you were merely a child in those days. I remember God.
Yeah, but then the kids in his class said a Willie was a penis, and so he was William the next day from then on.
I don't support Mom's opinion. It is a genocide, you know. Definitely.
I too differ with Becky's opinion on this, but it's important to clarify this because you'll find a lot of people who do. And therefore, you know, it's important to be able to go,
I supported them getting rid of Hamas. You know, I was like, yeah, you should get rid of Hamas. But then that's like Trump comes out and he's all like, oh, we just need to move all these people out. And it's all like, this is just like the Trail of Tears.
There will be hell to pay if you don't do what... actually, that's another issue.
I just about fell out of my chair when I heard him say that. I went, oh my God, I can't believe Trump just...
You just clap your
ethnically cleansing the Gaza.
Did you clap your hands with joy or in shock and horror?
I was kind of giddy about it, but I didn't really see it happening.
So you were happening at the prospect.
Yeah,
you
because
were thinking this would be a very good thing to get damn Palestinians out of the place where they've always lived.
Well, if they're going to set up a terror state there and shoot rockets all the time and suicide bomb. Who'd want them? They don't seem to be happy there.
No, you would support this ethnic cleansing because it, obviously the Palestinians are terrorists. Dare I call them human animals, perhaps?
You call them Palestinians, but I call them Arabs.
Whatever.
The 23 Arab countries have 640 times as much land as Israel. Why do they want to set up a 24th Arab state inside of Israel? And that's basically a terror state. I don't
I think you're misreading what you're misreading. I think
it's
what the
dead.
Even the claims of what people who don't even support even those who don't support a two-state solution who would prefer to see. I'm going to finish my sentence. Who would prefer to
Long
who
sentence.
Would? No, I haven't even. You know, I don't know. I've gotten 8 words into it, you know. Come on, Becky. Don't do the Zionist thing. We're trying to get facts revealed, at least the different positions revealed. That's the point. I never interrupt, as you know.
Never.
Never. Except for the occasional interruption from you, because you, when you speak falsely, I must interrupt because, you know. So there you have it.
Yes.
Yeah.
We understand. Mm-hmm.
Very
the,
good.
The,
very.
The
rules. The rules. Robert's
rules
of order. That's correct. Yes, thank you very much. All right, so there's a number of disagreements. I'm trying to put kind of clarify what each one is. The ethnic cleansing thing you are sympathetic with because you regard those who are being ethnically cleansed as merely effectuators of a terrorist state. True or false?
First off, no one's been ethnically cleansed.
I'm asking.
Ever.
No, I'm asking. I'm asking
years.
You. I'm asking you to answer my question. Please direct yourself to it. In other words, the question is: do you support Mr. Trump's proposal? He's full of shit, of course, because he likes to say whatever comes into his head. I have the feeling, but nonetheless, it's hard to take seriously anything he says one way or another. But nonetheless. Do you support that idea, that proposal?
If Qatar and Syria and Egypt and other Arab countries agree to take some of the Palestinians in, that would be a good thing. I would favor that. But I'll tell you that after Trump made that comment, the very next day, Israel put out an announcement saying that they were going to set up a process for relocating people out of Gaza voluntarily, and they threw that in. They were not going as far as...
I have always believed everything the Israeli government says without question, so I'm pleased you brought that up.
Okay. They've never ethnically cleansed any Palestinian ever.
Oh, and the West Bank, of course, that never happens, right?
They live there on the West Bank. The Palestinians live on the West Bank.
On some of it, where
they
haven't,
still live
where
there.
They haven't been evicted.
Who's been evicted from the West Bank?
Well,
talking Area A or Area B?
I am talking.
Nobody.
I'm talking.
A
I am talking about.
B.
I'm talking.
Area C is controlled by the IDF.
I'm talking about the removal of people in violation of the 1967 borders.
Not in violation. No, in adherence to the 1993 Oslo Accords, which set up Area C controlled by the IDF.
And we're going to pause here again at the Oslo Accords, which I tried to look into a little bit but didn't really get very deep into in the last week. I did read a critical analysis of the Oslo Accords. I think it was from an Israeli source, but I'm not sure. Maybe it was from a more critical source than... Even a so-called liberal Zionist in Israel. But the idea was that the reason the Oslo Accords had failed in the main, or at least in part, was because the Israeli government did not stop the huge increase in the settlers moving into the West Bank area and evicting Palestinians, or crowding them. So that there were, and also building roads that subdivided the area and turned it into functional Bantustans and so forth. We may get more into that because there's another half hour of this debate discussion, relatively friendly shouting match back and forth to go, which reveals some of the techniques that both those arguing. A pro-Palestinian liberation side, or trying to defend it, as I'm sort of rather ineffectually trying to do, and Becky's rather weathered and more detailed defense of a Zionist position, or at least presentation of a Zionist position. So anyway, we're going to leave that and take a musical break. This is the beginning of David Rovick's episode 11, which covers 2004 through 2008 of his History of the World According to David Rovick's. In this particular song, which is called After We Torture Our Prisoners, he talks about the Abu Ghraib prison torture scandal, which breaks in the New York Times.
After all the moralizing on the part of Bush administration officials and others about the depravity of Saddam's regime in Iraq, there was a certain depressing eloquence to the fact that the story exposed in April 2004 was that American soldiers were torturing Iraqi prisoners in the very same prison that had been notorious as a home for Saddam's torture chambers, Abu Ghraib. Incredibly, though, as the memory of this scandal apparently fades, or perhaps never made an impression at all in some circles, there has never been as much as a brief pause in the drumbeat of lecturing the world receives about human rights and freedom and democracy spewing from the mouths of the American political elite and their apologists.
We'll get rid of the dictator, rebuild your country, make sure all your kids go to school. We'll clean up the cities, get the sewage plants running, institute parliamentary rule. We'll bring you autonomy, senators and judges, and a shiny new blue banner. We'll bring you pride and prosperity, food in your bellies, and every home a phone, fax, and scanner. After we torture our prisoners, we'll bring you decades of peace, spiritual release, free religious expression. You can say what you want in the papers you run. We'll never force a confession after we torture our prisoners. The oil will flow just where it should go, across the desert and into the sea. You'll thank your God and the CIA that finally you are free. After we torture our prisoners, you'll all be safe with us to protect you and keep you out of harm's way. You'll thank creation and your liberation from the dark into a new day. After we torture our prisoners, you can all jump for joy, each girl and boy, and look boldly into the distance. You'll be so happy for all that we've done for such invaluable assistance. After we torture our prisoners, you won't have to worry about tyrants and bullies now that you have sovereignty. You can hold your head high, kiss Saddam goodbye, say hello to democracy. After we torture our prisoners, after we torture our prisoners.
And to conclude the contemporary edition of Bathrob Spears' Broadsides, the, I guess it's the April 6th edition, here's Caitlin Johnston talking about Trump sharing the collateral murder-style snuff film on the 15th anniversary of Collateral Murder, being read by her partner, Tim Foley.
There's Collateral Murder Styles. Trump shares Collateral Murder Style snuff film on 15th anniversary of Collateral Murder. President Trump has posted a video on social media showing a U.S. airstrike in Yemen killing dozens of people who he claims are Houthis gathered for instructions on an attack. Trump also bizarrely suggested that Ansar Allah has been sinking U.S. ships in its Red Sea attacks, writing, "They will never sink our ships again." There is no public information about any U.S. ships having been sunk by Houthi attacks. As of this writing, there is also no evidence supporting the president's claim that the people killed in the airstrike were combatants. There are photos online of unarmed Yemeni tribesmen standing in the exact formation seen in the video Trump posted for normal civilian gatherings. I've seen many observers comparing the video Trump posted to the leaked Collateral Murder video published by WikiLeaks in 2010, which showed U.S. servicemen firing on Iraqi civilians and journalists from Apache helicopters while laughing and joking about the carnage they were inflicting. What hasn't received quite enough attention is the fact that Trump actually shared his Collateral Murder-style snuff film on the 15th anniversary of the day WikiLeaks published Collateral Murder. Within hours of Trump's posting, the WikiLeaks Twitter account tweeted the following, quote, "On this day in 2010, Collateral Murder, WikiLeaks releases a secret U.S. military video depicting the indiscriminate slaying of over a dozen people in the Iraqi suburb of New Baghdad, including two Reuters news staff," end quote. For those who don't know, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was savagely persecuted by the U.S. government for the information he published in 2010, spending 2012 to 2019 trapped in the Ecuadorian embassy in London under political asylum from U.S. extradition attempts, and then jailed in a British maximum security prison on a U.S. extradition warrant from 2019 to 2024 before securing his freedom. It was the first Trump administration who had him dragged from the embassy for the crime of journalism in 2019. This is just the latest disgusting act of warmongering that Trump has inflicted on Yemen, and as always, it is completely unjustifiable. It's obviously idiotic to think bombing Yemen again will bring peace to the region. Only a foam-brained moron would believe such a thing. But it's also worse than that, because Trump wouldn't even have any moral legitimacy in bombing Yemen if peace really was his goal. Yemen is trying to stop an active genocide. That's what its Red Sea blockade has always been about. That's the only reason Ansara Law has ever attacked ships in the region. Their explicit and publicly stated goal is to exert pressure on Israel and its allies to halt the genocide in Gaza. Trump has no moral legitimacy in trying to stop Yemen from doing this. The New York Times reports that the Pentagon is telling Congress behind closed doors that Trump's costly war on Yemen is failing to achieve its objectives despite daily airstrikes. But even if Trump was successful in bombing Yemen into submission, all he'd be succeeding in doing is removing economic pressure on Israel to end its ongoing mass atrocity. Trump is actually bombing Yemen to defend Israel's right to commit genocide. Even if Trump could mass murder his way into ending the Houthi blockade, that wouldn't be peace, at least not the kind of peace that normal, healthy people care about. It would be the kind of peace that exists in a room full of corpses. The kind of peace that exists on a slave plantation, where all the slaves have been successfully whipped and tortured into obedience. When Trump's supporters babble about peace through strength, that is what they mean by peace. When normal, healthy people say peace, they mean the absence of abuse. When empire loyalists say peace, they mean obedience and submission to the empire. This is what people are saying when they claim there was a ceasefire on October 6th, implying that there was peace before Hamas launched its attack in 2023. They don't mean the same thing that normal, healthy people mean by peace. Their vision of peace was always Palestinians lying down and submitting and slowly getting shuffled out of the way, like the indigenous victims of other Western settler colonialist projects throughout history. That's not peace. That's just unresisted abuse. But that's the only kind of peace that Trump and his fellow empire managers will ever accept in the Middle East. The peace of compliance and obedience. The peace of prostration before the empire. The kind of peace you get when you start murdering everyone in the room until there's nobody left but corpses and those who submit to your will. This is who these people are. This is the closest thing to peace that they will ever allow under their rule.
And now comes a description of the flashbacks from two shows back in 2004. The first, which was initially broadcast on January 18th of 2004, is the concluding segment of the show, and that is, it discusses the arrest, my arrest, at the city council in January 2004 as part of a protest done by Huff and picked up also by the One Dance Summit, which is, as I think I may have mentioned before, a bit of number of leftists who had kind of gone into broader issues to get everybody together, the idea being one dance together with different people. But they wanted to also respect our struggle fighting the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz. Then we also have a lot of interviews with folks on the street. And an earlier and younger Scope It Out, Scott Graham, gives his critique of city council. And there's also a lot more in terms of, I think, Jason Pascal, the palmist and African-American outspoken critic of Santa Cruz rules, gets ticketed. I don't know if it was by then Sergeant Butchie Baker in his salad days. But then we have the January 22nd discussion or show, which goes again further into my arrest at city council and the crackdown that a previously liberal individual, Scott Kennedy, as mayor, unfortunately transformed into a, I'm afraid, a person molded by the power structure that he perhaps embraced with an attempt to originally be compassionate, more humane, more reasonable, more liberal, but eventually decided to do what was possible, which meant a deal with the Downtown Association, a deal with conservative forces that essentially involved the exclusion of the homeless, the visible homeless and poor, and the attempt to prioritize a more gentrified approach to the city. Anyway, you're going to hear all that, and remember that it's 2025 we're living in now, so references way back then may not be usable except as historical reference points. If you want to reach me and tell me what you see on the streets these days, or if you have objections or corrections to something I've put out here, please call me on the Huff line. It's now a cell phone. Woo-woo. You can text me as well at 831-423-4833. 831-423-4833. And I'll leave it there.